Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
If you're like me and you spend half your time going up and down the AM dial looking for talk radio, well, how about this? This is J. Michael Michael for LA Talk Radio. And why don't you go to a .com, www.com, or latalkradio.com and listen to their talk radio, because they've got everything. They've got music, they've got talk, they've got people self-help, they've got everything, and including the writer's best friend, the writer's block. So sit back, grab another wine, or in Bobby Jean's case, grab a cup of coffee and some Bailey's Irish Cream, because it all is going to start right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Bob Brill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Peter Gunn.
Yeah, Henry Mancini.
Bobby Jean, do you remember that?
I love that piece of music.
It is one of the best, isn't it?
It was a great show.
Yeah,
it was.
Great, and I loved it. He used to go into moms with the jazz. And Lola Albright was his girlfriend.
Was that the one that had they always had her legs.
Yes.
They always showed her legs. That was Mary Tyler Moore.
No, that was Richard Diamond.
Richard Diamond. Richard Diamond, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Do you know who played Richard Diamond on the radio?
Who?
Oh!
No, I don't.
Oh!
I'm sure if you're going to tell me that, I probably will remember.
I might be able to tell you if I can remember who it was now.
You can't remember either.
Oh, crap. Well, maybe our guest knows. I don't know. We'll ask him. Bobby Jean, how the heck are you?
I'm really good. I'm happy to be on tonight. It just doesn't feel right when I'm not here.
I know. Well, you know, it's not like you don't have any other radio keeping you busy during Thursdays.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. Oh, Dick Powell was Richard
Diamond. I'll be recording the show tonight. What were you going to say?
Oh, Dick Powell was Richard Diamond on the radio.
Oh, I was just going to look that up. You beat me to it.
I just, my brain kicked in for some strange reason. It must be the antihistamines. I don't know. I'm living on what is it? Not Corsedin, but it's the other one. I'm living on this stuff because my head has been so stuffy.
Well, at least it's not Oxycontin.
No. No, I wouldn't be living if it was Oxycontin, I'll tell you. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good.
Hey, man.
We had really interesting couple of weeks. You know, we married off a kid, and that was nice.
Yeah.
You know, last weekend. Yeah. So there was a perfect wedding. Everything was cool.
Great.
And, you know, so everything was good. And now the stress is over.
Yeah, for the time being.
Yeah.
Now you're going to get rid of the other one, and you'll be a happy guy.
So, no, everything's good.
Well, Bobby, if you remember, a member of the Writer's Block team is getting married on Saturday.
I know. I've been thinking about them and hoping they have a fabulous day.
Well, I'm sure they will, up to their knees in snow.
Now, where's Russ getting married? Yellowstone.
Yellowstone. So.
Well, you know, it was funny. Before we started, I was telling Bobby Jean, and then I never finished the story. Some of the folks came down for this wedding, came down from Canada, and one of the couples said, yeah, we were planning on going to Yosemite. And then we found out that it was 6 degrees overnight, or 21 degrees in human terms. And we're not going to go there. It's like, nah, I don't think so. 21 degrees, don't think so.
No, it gets a little cold.
Yeah, geez. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're from Canada, so,
yeah.
You know, it's not that bad, but it's still, you don't want to come down here and go
21 degrees in Canada is summer.
I know. Like my friend in Scotland, he said, They say, well, "What is that? It's humid."
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's get this guy in here because he's a great writer. His name is Elliot Parker, and he's the author of four novels, most recently A Knife's Edge, which was an honorable mention in thriller writing at the London Book Festival and is a sequel to the award-winning novel Fragile Brilliance. His novel Code for Murder was named a 2018 finalist for genre fiction by American Book Fest. He's a recipient of the West Virginia Literary Merit Award, and Fragile Brilliance was a finalist for the Southern Book Prize in thriller writing. He recently received with the Thriller Writing Award by the National Association of Book Editors, NABE, for his novels. Elliot is the host of a podcast program, Now Appalachia, which profiles authors and publishers living and writing in the Appalachian region and is heard on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network and Blog Talk Radio. A graduate of the Bluegrass Writers Studio at Eastern Kentucky University with his MFA, never mind, I'm not even going to try to do that, in creative writing, and Murray State University with his doctorate in English. He teaches English at the University of Mississippi and lives in Oxford, Mississippi and Chesapeake, Ohio. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Elliot Parker. Okay,
thank,
Elliot,
thank
you're
you
on.
Very much. Thank you for the round of applause. That was great.
Of course. We try to make everybody welcome. We had our guest last week said, I have to tell you that as soon as I heard the applause, I started waving.
Make that long walk down across the stage, Harry.
Well, the last time you were on, Elliot, we had a ball. So,
we did, yes. I enjoyed it very much, and I appreciate you guys having me back on again.
Well, you know, there's certain guests we rush to get back on, and you're one of them because you're such a good guest, and so welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. A Knife's Edge. It's a new thriller from a West Virginia author. Now, you're from West Virginia, but you don't live in West Virginia. You live in Mississippi and Ohio and...
Right. Yeah, I was born and raised in West Virginia, and I lived in Ohio for about I went to school in West Virginia for a while. Went to Marshall University, then lived in Kentucky for a while. I went to school and then lived in Ohio for a while, and now I'm living in Oxford, Mississippi. So
right.
I just kind of bounced around all around those Appalachian states for the last 17, 18 years or so.
Okay. Now, for those who don't know, Ohio, of course, is right across the border from West Virginia.
Which is right next door to my hometown of Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, right. And there's an old joke about West Virginians and the Ohioans. I don't know if you ever heard it, Elliot, about the West Virginian wanted to come over to Ohio, and there was no bridge. And the guy in Ohio said, well, here, no problem. Well, I'll just turn the flashlight on, and you can walk across the beam. And the guy from West Virginia says, no, because I'll get halfway across you, turn off the damn flashlight.
I had not heard that one, but that's great.
Yeah,
I've spent time living in both of those states. I can tell you that there's probably a kernel of truth or two.
Oh, I'm sure, absolutely certain.
That joke.
I'm absolutely well. I know that West Virginians and Ohioans don't get along all that well. So
right yes.
Anyway, tell us a little bit about Knife's Edge. I know it's got our favorite hero, Ronan McCullough, back in it. He's a South Carolina, he's a Charleston detective. So why don't you kind of give us what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. This book, A Knife's Edge, picks up 6 months after the end of Fragile Brilliance. And basically, what has happened at the beginning of Knife's Edge, or what is going on at the beginning of Knife's Edge, not only has six months passed since Fragile Brilliance ended, but Ronan and his colleagues in the Charleston Police Department are still fighting kind of the drug scourge and the drug plague that was brought on by the criminal syndicate from the first book,
right,
from Fragile Brilliance. And those guys have been arrested, and the syndicate has been kind of broken up, but the remnants of that are still there, and,
right,
and the drugs that they brought in and the people that are pushing them are still there. So Ronan is still fighting that battle. But what happens in A Knife's Edge is Ronan is attending a function, sort of a celebration or congratulatory junket for a hospital wing that has been built at Charleston Mercy Hospital. And this ties back into Fragile Brilliance, not to get too much into it, but there was a small plot line there where Ronan's partner, Ty, was trying to raise money for a new children's cancer wing at Charleston Mercy Hospital where he works, where Ty works. And so the book opens up with Ronan fighting the drug pushers and the drug issues still, but also Ty has been able to work with a team that has raised enough money for the cancer wing. And a company named BTECH, letter B-T-E-C-H, helped provide the last bit of funding that they needed to build the cancer wing. So they're at this party, sort of a junket to kind of celebrate and, you know, congratulate everybody for the fundraising. And Ronan is there to provide security. If you've ever gone to those junkets, and a lot of people have, you know, there's always police presence there. You know, usually it's police officers, you know, are hired or sure. assigned to work these events to provide security. So Ronan's there. While they're at the junket, and they're at a building called the Clay Center, which is in downtown Charleston, really, really nice performing arts venue there in the middle of the city. A Hummer vehicle comes careening through the glass window where they're having the reception and having the kind of the food and the speaking and all of that. A Humvee kind of crashes through the window and, you know, takes out a bunch of people, you know, tears up the room and everything like that. And, you know, Ronan and Ty are both there. So they get kind of knocked out, and Ronan gets up and, you know, he realizes he's the only person there in a chaotic situation that's got a gun and has really got the authority to kind of handle the situation. And when they go to, when he approaches the vehicle, approaches the Hummer, he finds that there's a guy, the driver, has been shot in the side of the head, and in the back of the trunk of that car is the body of Sarah Gilmore, who is an acquaintance of his and Ty's. And so he has to figure out, you know, why, first of all, is she in the back of that car dead, and why was she stuffed in the back of this car, and why was this car sent careening through this glass window on a night that was supposed to be such a positive event for everyone involved, but also a positive event for the Charleston community to have this new cancer wing now ready to be opened and serve patients. So a lot going on there at the beginning. It kind of picks up very quickly with a fast beginning, and Ronan and Ty are kind of thrust in them to the midst of another dangerous situation as they move forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know because when we went through Fragile Brilliance, a lot of people were not aware. In fact, I think that was Fragile Brilliance was your first Ronan novel. Isn't that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. And I think it took about a quarter of the way through the book until we finally realized that Ronan had a boyfriend named Ty. Mm-hmm. And right. it was kind of a surprise to, I think, a lot of people. That I like Ty as a character. He's really great. And he has a really good common sense and a good head on his shoulders. So good for you for bringing him back. I let me ask you this question, Elliot, because I have written sequels. I know how it is sometimes to write a sequel. How is it for you to sit down and try to pen a sequel that is as interesting and as good as the first one?
We know, Jim, it was really challenging, and it was a lot harder than I really thought it was going to be. On the one hand, I enjoyed writing it because I got a chance to spend more time with Ronan and Ty and all the characters, basically all the characters that were featured in Fragile Brilliance, make an appearance again in A Knife's Edge. So right. kind of bringing all those characters back and spending time with them was a lot of fun. But at the same time, it's also challenging because while you want your characters to kind of maintain a sense of truth to who they are,
right.
at the same time, as a writer, you've got to show them grow and develop in certain ways. And so you don't want them to be the same character at the end of the second book that they were at the end of the first book in the series.
Right.
So that was challenging a little bit for me because I wanted them to have, you know, the core values and the core kind of personality traits. You were talking about Ty and some of his characteristics, mm-hmm. about, you know, being level headed and kind of keeping Ronan in check when he's ready to fly
right.
off the handle for different reasons. And
right,
so,
right,
you know,
right.
you want those characteristics to be the same, but at the same time, you've got to show them grow and they have to grow and develop. And for me, that was the biggest challenge is making the growth incremental, but also by the end of the second book, by the end of A Knife's Edge, to kind of say, oh, you know, these two characters are the same, but they, because of their experiences and circumstances, they're now totally different than they were when we started the book.
Right.
And they're totally different and they've grown and developed in many ways that was very different from how Fragile Brilliance ended.
That was
the big challenge, but I feel like it was a challenge that was well worth it. I feel like that both of those characters, by the time we get to the end of A Knife's Edge, we see different sides of their persona that maybe we didn't see in Fragile Brilliance. That I feel like as a writer, if you liked Ronan and you liked Ty and you liked some of those other characters, you know, you're gonna be endeared to them more after you see their progression in the second book.
Right. Do you find yourself putting your characters, especially Ronan, he's your protagonist, and Ty, do you see yourself in chapter after chapter putting them in situations where a different personality trait is bound to come out or has to come out?
Yes. That is something that when I was kind of outlining the structure of the story, I wanted to make sure occurred. And just to give you an example of what, you know, without giving too much away to the story, you know, Ty, for example, we've been talking about him a little bit. He gets much more involved in the investigation that Ronan is trying to undertake in terms of who killed Sarah Gilmore and who was this driver that was shot in the head, obviously, that led to the careening of the Humvee into the Clay Center. You know, did he know her? Did he not know her? Was he killed first? Was she killed? All that kind of stuff. Ty also gets involved more heavily in the investigation because he also knew Sarah Gilmore, because at one time Sarah Gilmore was Ty's colleague in the emergency room at Charleston Mercy Hospital. So, you know, we see Ty crossing that threshold that worries Ronan so much, which is his line of work, putting, you know, Ty and people that is in Ronan's circle and his family and inner circle in grave danger. You know, that's a point that he emphasizes a lot in Fragile Brilliance. He wants to keep that separate as best he can. Well, now because Ty knew Sarah and there's all these other circumstances going on,
right,
that happened at the event that was trying to celebrate the opening of the cancer center and all of this, you know, so Ty gets much more involved and he puts himself in physical risk in this. And we see him and Ronan have some very difficult conversations about this. And, Ronan kind of at one point in the book tells Ty, you know, I don't want you doing this anymore. I want you to stay out of this investigation. And Ty says, you know, basically tells Ronan in not so many words, you know, stuff it. I'm already involved.
Right.
And I'm involved in everything that you do as a, you know, being in a relationship with you and the work that you do. I'm always involved, even if I'm not directly involved.
Right.
So we see his development in that regard. We see that side of his personality and kind of how Ronan responds to Ty basically telling him, you know, to stuff it about, you know, not getting involved.
Right.
And so how does Ronan handle that? How does Ronan handle that? Because, you know, when he's rebuked by Ty, because he doesn't get rebuked by him very often, but not and especially not in that steadfast way.
Right.
So that's an example of some of the growth that you see, you know, and you see that, you know, and then so Ronan kind of goes off and, you know, keeps investigating, but pouts a little bit at the same time after Ty rebukes him a little bit. And then Ty realizes he was a little strong in his wording and how he phrased things. And so they come back together and have a more honest and frank discussion about what's going on. So, you know, those are an example of some of the things that I tried to include in those chapters, in addition to the typical things you'd want to see in a thriller story in terms of, you know, the action and investigating and all of that.
Sure. I just have one more question before I turn Bob and Bobby loose on you. And I know Bobby Jean's probably sitting over there, sitting on her hands, just jumping up and down, going, ooh, 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 me. out of both your main characters, Ronan and Ty, Ronan, I assume, and I'm going to guess because having written characters much like him, I'm going to guess that he is fairly simple to write. He's straightforward. He's you know, he's got his temper quirks. He does his thing. Ty is the one I would guess that's got a little bit more challenge to write because he can go right up to the line and not put his foot over it. And it amazes me how you've written him. Can you comment on that at all?
Oh, sure. Well, thank you for that, first of all. And Ty, you know, Ty is able to go up right up against that line really for a couple of different reasons. Number one, you know, he thinks differently than Ronan does. You know, Ronan is, you know, a very kind of black and white thinker.
Right.
He doesn't see a lot of gray in a lot of situations. Ty does. He sees the best in people. You know, Ty, one of the storylines that we see develop in Fragile Brilliance, and it develops more, and we were talking about growth in characters, you know, Ty and Ronan's nephew, Nick, who kind of shows up unannounced in Fragile Brilliance. Ty and Nick, excuse me, have a very close relationship. In many ways, it's the kind of relationship that Ronan wishes he had with his nephew. But Ty is able to forge a stronger connection with Nick,
right,
because he doesn't see things in black and white, and he understands and sympathizes with some of what Nick's feeling and experiencing.
Right.
And some of that, too, is because of the age difference. You know, Ronan is, you know, a little older than
right.
Ty, and so that, you know, Ty can identify with that. But yeah, Ty's profession, you know, he's working in a situation in an emergency room hospital where there's not a lot of black and white. There's a lot of gray and
right.
everything that goes on there and every patient and every situation. So he brings that perspective, I think, to Ronan's life and to the conversations that they have about, you know, what's going on in their lives. And he, you know, while Ronan works so hard to keep their relationship secret from everyone, Ty understands why that's important. And he understands, where Ronan's just like, we have to keep this separate and nobody can know and all of this, because Ty sees things differently and kind of sees the gray in things. I mean, while he doesn't like it, he understands and kind of goes along with what Ronan tries to do to keep things secret. So I think all of those things allow Ty to kind of operate in this interesting space with
right.
Ronan, where he can do things and say things and have a relationship with Ronan that really nobody else in Ronan's life can have without him, you know, getting aggressive.
Right, flying off the handle,
pushing back.
Right, right. Well, Ty, it seems to me like he's more of a full picture guy. And
yeah,
Ronan is
yeah.
more of a tunnel vision cop guy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Ty sees the big picture and he sees a lot of things as kind of a long game.
Exactly.
Where Ronan very much operates kind of day to day, moment to moment, and is looking and wants those moments to connect. You know, wants one plus two to equal three, and can't understand and gets frustrated when that doesn't happen. Where Ty understands that, you know, sometimes one plus two doesn't always equal three.
Exactly. Exactly. So. All right, Bobby.
I'm actually going to be chivalrous here because I know how Bobby is probably waiting, biting at the bit.
I know.
So
she's
I'm going to be chivalrous and go ahead and defer to Bobby Jean.
Oh my goodness.
Something you always wanted, but were afraid to ask, Bobby Jean.
Well, no, because you've already covered a lot of the different things that I thought were so interesting that I would have brought up. What I will say, Elliot, is this book is a fast page turning romp from the get-go, even before the event that you describe with the Hummer crashing into the building. You already, from like page one, have us in the palm of your hand. And I was exhausted at the end of every chapter, feeling like, you know, we have very little reprieve of an opportunity to breathe, I think. I was very interested in how you wove the first book in, because I think as the sequel, which y'all just talked about so wonderfully, you know, you do not need to have read book one to get this book. But the way that you wove in the previous story by dropping hints to us as a reader, which actually was helpful to me because it helped me remember some things from the first book.
Right.
And if I were coming to it fresh, I wouldn't feel like I had no idea what's going on. And I think that the dynamic between the three men is so interesting, and it isn't really what we get in. There's a very human element woven throughout your stories, and that is, of course, Ronan and Ty, but also Nick. And when you were talking about growth of character, you know, we see that with Nick in this book. Talk a little bit about, and actually, you know, you've all covered, I think, a lot of the basics. I was also intrigued with this idea of the B-Tech company.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like they're ripped out of the headline. But since I don't read current news a whole lot, where did you get the idea for B-Tech?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you a quick story on how I came up with that concept. I was at a bookstore a couple of years ago, and it was on a Friday night. It might have been in the summertime, about this time of year, you know, late spring, early summer, and I was just looking through the magazine racks, and I saw Time Magazine And I was sitting there, and there was a cover with this very attractive looking younger blonde headed woman on the front cover. And she was Time's Person of the Year or Innovator of the Year or something like that. Her name was Elizabeth Holmes. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. And the title was something like Innovator of the Year, Holmes Revolutionizing or Revolutionizing the Way Blood Analysis is Done or something like that. It had some subheading on the cover. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. So I started flipping through. And long story short, she had created or founded a company called Theranos. I think it's spelled T-H-E-R-N-O-S. And she had gotten a group of investors to kind of fund this. She ran it through Stanford University in California, where not too far from where you guys are, where she had some connections there and knew some faculty there. But anyway, she had invented a device and some equipment that could analyze disease, could analyze blood alcohol content, could analyze drugs, can analyze anything you want to know about what is in someone's system, either a drug or a virus or cancer or whatever could be harming them by a single drop of blood. And you basically could you know, just with a pinprick of someone's finger, you could diagnose, according to her, you know, hundreds and hundreds of diseases and illnesses just by this one little drop of blood. Well, long story short, she got CVS to buy into this process. CVS was going to put these machines that Theranos had created in these little kiosks and all kinds of stores around the country so that people could come in. You know, you could check your cholesterol. You could find out if you had you know, any kind of disease, high blood pressure, if you had any drugs in your system. I mean, all could be done by this. Well, long story short, it ended up, the technology ended up being a fraud, and she's been investigated and has been basically shamed. And CBS, 60 Minutes of CBS News did a big expose last year on her. And,
big time.
Yeah, so she's been basically, she's basically been proven as a fraud. But I got to thinking, Bobby Jean, what would happen if that kind of technology could happen and could be used effectively, but what if that fell into the wrong hands? What if a group of criminals had that technology, and all of a sudden they could manipulate blood testing, they could manipulate any kind of DNA that police would investigate and collect from suspects? You know, what would happen if that technology fell into the wrong hands? And so it's kind of loosely based on Holmes's company, but you know, I kind of take it in a different direction to where, you know, other things other than blood can be analyzed. You know, you can analyze DNA swabs and those kinds of things. But, you know, it was loosely based on her company and that technology. And because I was thinking about what's going to be my plot for the next Ronin book. Mm-hmm. And when I read that article, I thought, oh, I've got it. I have got it. I was pretty sure nobody else had written, had had a plot out there in the thriller genre around this. And so I did a lot of research. I talked to a couple of hematologists, you know, doctors who deal with blood and can diagnose things like leukemia and those kinds of things, and ask them about, you know, how does your blood testing work? You know, if you have a patient, you know, when you take a vial of blood, where does it go? You know, what are they testing? How do they test it? How long does it take? Which was a challenge for me because I'm not a science and math person. And so it was a stretch for me, and really an intellectual stretch, because a lot of that stuff kind of just, you know, goes over my head a little bit. But so it was a great learning experience, but I just felt like it made a great plot for a story, because I just kept thinking, what if this kind of technology fell into the wrong hands? And kind of the impetus for what happens in a knife's edge is the state of West Virginia is having financial problems. And so they've outsourced all of their, blood analysis and DNA testing to this BTEC company. And of course, BTEC is manipulating and falsifying the results and turning those into the police. And suddenly people they think are suspects, or, you know, there's no DNA evidence to prove it. And it's just kind of throwing the whole criminal justice system into chaos. And
right.
So,
Elliot,
the murder of Sarah Gilmore's tied into that and all of that.
Right.
So, but it was a lot of fun to kind of work that kind of somewhat true to life story into the plot.
Well, Elliot, I do want to ask you about that coming up, but I think Jim wants to take a break.
Yeah, let's get a break out of the way. Bobby Jean, you got your stuff in front of you?
Oh, I do. Wait. I do. I have it.
Oh, wait a minute. That sounds like ooh.
Got to reach out in this other little pile here. Out West Shop launches 30 deals 30 Days Shopping Extravaganza. From now until June 16th, a new deal is posted on the Out West Shop Facebook page at midnight, by the way, and also on www.outwestshop.com. To browse all the current deals, just go to that website, put the word deal in the search box, and you'll see all the current available deals will come up. These are limited quantities, so you don't want to dally. The cool thing about this is Jim and I and Out West Shop have always been huge supporters of the creative spirit and of musicians and authors and such. And so 50% of the retail price for each of these deals is being donated to our buddies, the Cowboy Way Trio. Jim Jones, who's been a guest on this show, is part of the Cowboy Way. And they've launched an Indiegogo campaign. It's a Cowboy I Will Be documentary. They're trying to raise $18,000. And they're going to Scotland. They have a bunch of gigs in Scotland, and they're going to do a documentary following the history of the Scottish cowboys that come from Scotland to the United States. And they have a really big dream of a film they want to do based on their time in Scotland, and then when they're back in the States. And we love to throw our support where we can. So this helps to hopefully raise them a little bit of money. So if you have questions, call us toll free, or you'd like some personal assistance, 1-877-340-9378. And remember, it's always a great day to go shopping out west.
You know, if you are planning a trip and there's no way you can take your canine buddy, how about considering All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover? That's right. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. If you want a place where you know your buddy will be safe and have lots of attention, being able to play with other dogs, goats, sheep, horses, and more humans, then All Dogs Rule is the place for you. Acres of play space, grass, orange trees, the gorgeous Sespe River, and all with no stress and extras if you want. All you have to do is ask. So when your dog returns home, you'll have to ask, whose vacation was better? So check them out at their website, alldogsrule.com, or give them a call at 805-524-1100. Your dog will thank you. And when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed that they weren't the same as other publicity firms. They work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet clients' goals. So Creative Edge, it's your brand and your future. Mickey Mickelson and Avery Olive are publicists, and you can get them at creative.edgepublicity and give them a holler. Their phone number's there. Great people, and actually they're Bob and I's publicists, and we love them, and they're fun.
Yep,
and they're just you can't beat them for publicists.
No, they're very, very good, and you know, I mean, price wise, everything, the way they structure things, it's better than pretty much any other publicist.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Creative Edge, it's your publicity. Okay, it is now 7:33. We're back in the studio, and with Elliot Parker. And if you'd like to call and talk to Elliot tonight, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that in number is 818-602-4929. And Bob, I believe you had something you wanted to say.
I do. I have a question. And it deals with one of the things you brought up, Elliot, was and Bobby Jean brought up, was sort of ripped from the headlines type of stuff. And as we know in the current situation, you're dealing with drug dealers here, and drug dealers today are legitimate doctors. And in your part of the country, in the Appalachia world, one of the worst parts in the country of the opioid epidemic. And I was wondering how tempted you were and to weave your criminals into your drug dealers into the doctor world and dealing with that part of it even in a deeper way.
That's actually a pretty good question.
Yeah, Bob, it was really interesting. Part of what makes this BTEC company so deadly in the story is the fact that instead of kind of operating on their own, they're using some of the leftover drug pushers from the syndicate that was kind of brought down in Fragile Brilliance. And so that they've teamed up and they've teamed up together because you've got there's a doctor in the story named Richard Metzger, who's kind of the brains behind what B-Tech is doing. And he's making sure that, the equipment to manipulate the test results and to manipulate the blood analysis and DNA and all of that is working properly. But they're using the lower level people on the streets to continue to, kind of push the drugs and kind of continue the operations that were so frustrating to Ronan and everybody in the first book. And so it really kind of creates this sort of, I don't want to say mega syndicate, but kind of this really deadly, lethal, dangerous group of people that on the one hand are, confronting the police on the street level, but at the same time are, behind the scenes manipulating. When the police are making inroads, they're manipulating the evidence and getting criminals, off and getting them, giving prosecutors the wrong information and giving the investigating officers wrong information. And they think they've got something and then they have nothing and all of that. And one thing I forgot to mention to Bobby Jean's question a moment ago is how it works in West Virginia, and every state's different. For a lot of our small counties and cities in the state, there is a state police. The state police, the West Virginia State Police, maintains what they call it a crime lab, but it's basically where smaller police departments and smaller communities, when they're investigating, drug offenses or, drug rings, or trying to break up, these people that are pushing these terrible drugs in Appalachia, you can send your evidence to the state police crime lab and they will do all the testing and all of that for you. And so part of what's going on in the story is the state has run out of money and they've outsourced, as I mentioned a moment ago, that all those processes to B-Tech. But that again is kind of based kind of up from a rip from the headlines. I mean, that is actually true. A lot of your smaller community, Charleston Police Department, doesn't send all of their stuff necessarily to the state police crime lab. They're able to kind of analyze some of their own stuff because they're a bigger department. But where B-Tech and these low level pushers are really going to do a lot of damage is in your smaller communities. And so they're kind of starting in Charleston first because that's been a soft spot that was developed from the first book, and they're kind of widening that and expanding that. And there's a scene in A Knife's Edge where Richard Metzger's kind of looking at some evidence that's been sent to him by another county sheriff's department, and he's thinking about, okay, I realize now I'm gonna, this person's gonna take the fall for it, but at the same time, we're gonna get this person off and get this person's evidence manipulated because I'm being paid, by these same drug pushers and by this same deadly group to falsify this evidence. So it's this big circular kind of super syndicate that's developed that makes them very deadly and very lethal. And it was a lot of fun to write, and at the same time really challenging to write because there's a lot of wheels turning at the same time that you have to kind of keep moving in the same direction.
Gotcha. One more question about your book, and then we have to get into some process.
Okay.
In book one, or the first book, there's a character that shows up at Ronan and Ty's house, and she's not very nice. Her name is Melissa, and is yeah. And it's Ronan's sister, and she's kind of like the Uber bitch, but she doesn't show up in this book. Now, in your third book, is Melissa going to be back?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that, Jim. That is, when I've spoken to other folks and I've given talks about the book, folks that have read Fragile Brilliance, that's one of the first questions I get is, what happened to Melissa? She was such a vile, repulsive,
oh my God, she was horrible
in the first book. and just everything that you hate in a character. And not only does she embody it, but she says it over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly right. And I think in A Knife's Edge, there's only her name's only mentioned one time. I think there's actually one sentence where her name's mentioned. But I can assure you in book three, she's coming back in full force.
Oh, my God.
And if you thought she was nasty and repulsive in Fragile Brilliance, you just wait, because something's going to happen to Nick. And I don't want to give too much away, but something's going to happen to Nick that is going to send her back to Charleston in a full-fledged rage. And when she comes back, there's going to be a lot of problems for Nick and Ronan and Ty, because she's coming with her horns out, and it's going to be pretty interesting.
Well, it sounds like that information is giving Bobby apoplexy.
I only had one last question on this book, and I kind of gave up on a body count. Do you know how many bodies are left on the ground in a nice edge?
The first one was pretty bad. So
there's a lot. I had a reader email me maybe about a month or two ago. Maybe it's been three months ago now, and said said some very nice things about the book, but their last line of their email message was, "Oh my goodness, I knew this was going to be great because there were six dead people by chapter five," or
yeah,
something like
least.
That. And I hadn't sat down and actually counted that up, but there's a lot. The bodies pile up quickly in the story. But another challenge with Jim was talking about writing a sequel and kind of carrying the story forward is you've got to make sure that the people that you are, I think, as a thriller writer, the people that you're killing are dying for a purpose.
Right.
That their death is a part of the larger storyline. You're not just,
it's not just,
you know,
gratuitous.
Exactly. And even the people, you know, even the people that are, you know, that are killed in that incident, the Clay Center, where the Humvee kind of goes through the glass window. I mean, even though they're not named and we don't know a lot about them, you know, their deaths mean something to the overall larger structure of the story. And
right.
So, I think that's what separates thrillers from sometimes horror novels or horror genres, that the killings in thrillers are for a purpose, that it has a connection to the larger story as a whole. It's not just killing for killing's sake.
Right. You know, Bobby, it's just like in Jefferson's Chance when Sandy and Stinky get it.
Yeah.
The reason the whole reason for them dying was that they could give Jefferson and Caleb the information about the Comanches. So that was, I mean, besides the fact that they were just nefarious assholes.
Well, yeah, we were happy to see them leave the story. They had done their bit, and
yes,
we were very happy to have
them. We were happy to have them go, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Elliot, we talked about writer's block the last time you were here, and Bobby Jean, I'm sure, is going to want to ask you this question.
Elliot, do you get writer's block, and what do you do about it if you get it? And if you don't get it, why don't you think you do?
Well,
that's a great question. I don't think I get full-fledged writer's block in terms of what a lot of people think writer's block is, where you go sometimes days or weeks or months and can't write anything. I don't get that level of writer's block, but I do have days and I do have moments when I'm writing a novel. Even a novel like A Knife's Edge, where I'm familiar with a lot of the characters from the previous book, I do have moments where, you know, the writing doesn't come as easily, and it's a slow go for a lot of reasons, a lot of different reasons. You know, I try to write a little bit each day. You know, usually I get up early in the morning and do it, especially during the semesters when I'm teaching, although you know, my job at the University of Mississippi is going to allow me, you know, more time to write and more, you know, more flexibility in my hours in terms of not having to get up so early every morning to write. But my point being, you know, some of those mornings I'm able to sit down and crank out, you know, if I'm writing 45 minutes or an hour, I can crank out 250, 400, 500 words. Some days it's 25 words. Some days it's 50 words. Some days it's 100 words. It just kind of ebbs and flows depending on where I am in the story, what chapter I'm working on, where are we in the plot of the book, and other factors too. You know, how tired I am that morning, and you know, what kind of a week have I had? If it's Thursday and I've had a really tough week, you know, sometimes the brain just, the synapses in the brain don't snap like you want them
to. Sure.
But I think I think the important thing, Bobby Jean, is to keep moving forward and to realize, for me anyway, to realize that every day is not going to be a 500-word day. And I don't put myself on word limits. I know some writers do. Some writers say, you know, I'm not getting up from the computer till I write 250 words or something like that. I don't do that. I work on like a clock schedule. You know, I'm going to write for 45 minutes and I start the timer. But the goal is to keep moving forward. And even if I only generate 45 words that day, at least I'm moving forward. You know, I'm not letting all those factors I was just talking about slow down the progress of the book.
Right.
And I just tell myself, you know what? You had 45 words today. Tomorrow you might get 150 or 200. Now, in the summertime and things like that, I'm able to, you know, certainly write longer and produce more work. But I, to me, that's how I've gotten over the writer's block problem, is always move forward and always make progress. Don't go backwards. Don't stand still. But don't put yourself under some kind of an arbitrary word count or some kind of a goal that you may not be able to meet, because, you know, once you go down that road and once you tell yourself, oh, I didn't meet that goal today, or, oh, this is the third day in 3 weeks I didn't meet this goal or that, you know, then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then it gets harder to sit down and write.
So right. And, you
that's
know,
what I do. I just always try to move forward.
We've had writers tell us, well, I have to sit down. I have to write 500 words a day or 250 words a day. And they're not getting up from that computer until they do write those 250 or 500 words a day. And then they tell the next breath, the next thing out of their mouth is, and then the next day I got to go back and rewrite it because it wasn't very good.
Well, and the other thing is, too, if you get into that mode, it becomes a job.
Right.
And as a writer,
it's no longer fun.
Yeah, well, you know, as far as for me, I got a job. I don't want to write. My writing is not a job to me.
Right.
It flows and it runs, and I got some goals. Yeah, I want to make it, you know, to when the book's going to be finished and stuff.
Right.
But it should be fun. It shouldn't be a hobby, because you do want to get paid for your work. But, you know, you still don't want it to become the job where you're going to job 9 to 5. Every day.
Like James Patterson pops out a new novel every 90 days. Boom, boom, boom,
right.
Boom. And how many of them are really good? Most of them are readable.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how many of them are. I mean, they're not near as good as the first Alex Cross novels.
Sure.
You know, I mean, Along Comes His Fighter.
I agree.
You know, I mean, you know what? Elliot, we're out of time, dude. It's fast 50 minutes, man. I'm telling you. We got talking about your book.
Talk too much.
Well, no, this is your show. So talk as much as you like, but it's, I mean, we got a lot of information out there in a lot, you know, in the hour that we're over 50 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, wow. And, you know, we are going on hiatus next month, but, we will be back in September, August to September. I'm guessing probably September. And, you know, we'll get with you. And when you get this new book, Ronan's new book done, we'll get you back on the show.
That's great, Jim. Thanks to you and to Bob and to Bobby Jean for having me on. Appreciate it so much. Always enjoy talking to you. And thanks for all the good work you do for authors everywhere.
Well, thank you.
To give us a platform and an opportunity to talk about our work.
Really, well, thank you. It. Now, before you go, you want to give people the information where they can find you? I know you have a webpage.
Yeah, sure. My website is just my name, Eliot Parker. All one word, .com. I'm on Facebook, so you can just type in my name, and I'm there. I'm on Twitter, although I tend to be more of a reader of Twitter, not much of a tweeter, but my handle is E4419, and I'm also on Facebook, I'm on Facebook, I'm also on Instagram, and my handle there, my name there is just Eliot, E-L-I-O-T, .Parker. And you can get A Knife's Edge or Fragile Brilliance or any of my books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get audiobooks of all of them, Kindle copies, you know, printed copies, but anywhere you like to buy books. But I do encourage you, if you live in a community where you have a local independent bookstore and you'd like to get a copy of the book, please check out those folks first, because our independent bookstores are so important to our communities.
Absolutely.
And what they do for authors.
So
absolutely.
If you'd like to get a copy, and you can get one from one of those stores, please do.
Oh, absolutely. And Elliot, the address I have for you is in Ohio. It is now Mississippi.
Right. Yes. I recently took a new job at the University of Mississippi, teaching English and creative writing. And so I still got my Ohio address, but I'll be moving down to Mississippi on a more permanent basis here over the summer.
Okay, so if I send the mug to Ohio, you're going to get it?
Yes, I'll certainly get it, yes.
That's okay, cool. And thanks so much for joining us and spending your evening. I know it's late there, so have yourself a great rest and drink the rest of that wine, and
And Ohio's a whole lot easier to spell than Mississippi.
Easier than Albuquerque, too.
Albuquerque. I wouldn't even attempt that sober. Okay. Okay. Thanks so much for joining us, Elliot. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's Elliot Parker, and he's a great guest. My goodness. Bob, were you sleeping over here?
Well, no. It was. I was going to ask him if, in listening to his answers, I know, I'm hoping that he puts punctuation in his books. Because there was none in his answers.
He answered his questions with answers to other questions that you might have had.
Yes. Right, and I did. Yes. So it was like,
It just ran right through it, which is perfect. Next week we have one.
I think I watched some of his interviews with the show that he does.
Yes.
And those are also really great shows. He's a great interviewer.
Yeah, I've watched a couple of his shows. He's a good interviewer.
Yeah.
Very good. Next week we have one of Mickey Mickelson's writers on, Kimberly Stewart. She's from Iowa. And she'll be joining us for their newest book, Heartland. And she also has 11 other books available on Amazon.
Wow.
My God, she's prolific.
Wow.
And then Thursday the 13th, Peggy Chambers will be our guest. We'll have Bob will be here, Russ will be here, Jerry will be here, I'll be here, Bobby, you'll be on the phone. And we'll talk with Peggy, and then we're going to talk about the show and how much fun we've had in the last 4 years doing this show live.
Yeah.
And it's still going to be live. We're just going to have to get together and talk about, are we going to do it on the phone or what's going to be happening. So don't go away, Bobby, because we're damn sure going to talk.
You know where I live.
I do. I can't spell it, but I know where it is.
Okay. What, New Mexico?
Yeah, Peggy's new book is Witch's Cliff. She's also right, Globe Valley, Return to Globe Valley, Secrets of Sand Hill Island, The Stones of Sand Hill Island. I mean, she's got just a ton of books, too, and she's just the nicest lady and a great writer, just a wonderful writer. So we're looking forward to having her back on the show. And with that being said, if anybody hasn't got any wise words of wisdom going on, Bob?
Yeah, I got a new book out.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, the one I did. I formatted it for you. Yeah.
It's 37 pages long. It's just a very short book, and it's called Beating the Slump, An Athlete's Guide to a Better Career. And it's basically very, very simple. You can read it in 20 minutes.
Yep.
The idea is to put two practices, if you're a golfer or a baseball or softball player or whatever, help you get out of that slump based on some things that they used to teach at the Kansas City Royals Academy back in the late 1960s, early 70s. So.
And in case you're interested, I actually formatted that book.
He did.
I did.
He formatted the book?
I did.
My wife took the photos for the cover, and I designed the cover.
There you go. See, look at that.
Yeah, the whole world was there.
It's just the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's just a big family thing. Well, Bobby, enjoy your show on Saturday. We are going to have house showings, of course, this weekend, and Jerry's having surgery tomorrow, so we're going to be a little tied up. But other than that, we are looking forward to getting our house sold and getting moved and everything happening for us. And
leaving sunny Southern California.
God, you just can't afford to live here anymore.
I know. It's
horrid.
It's not easy.
That's the same thing Bobby and Jim were finding out.
Yeah,
yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay, so for Bob Berlin, Bobby Jean Bell, and myself, Jim Christina, and the crew of the Writer's Block, we bid you adieu. We have killed another Thursday evening, and we are out of here.